Hey, this is Kevin Michael Richardson of G.I. Joe Renegades, voice of Roadblock, and you listen to What's on Joe Mind.
Welcome to episode 48 of What's on Joe Mind. We're a fan cast about the world of G.I. Joe. With Rollout Roll Call and Joe Lana behind us, we are now T-minus 99 days until JoeCon. That means we're T-minus 100 days until the opening day of G.I. Joe Retaliation, and now 142 days until the Canadian JoeCon. Hello again, everybody. I'm Gary. Joining me is Chuck. Chuck, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, buddy.
Well, that's good. Anything exciting happened this week with you?
Yes, and I'm going to get to that in the shout-out section.
Fantastic. Well, that's probably a good time that we move on to the next guy, since Chuck doesn't have anything else to share with us. He is at the news desk. He's admin of JoeSightings.com. It's Mike. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing good, Gary. How about yourself?
How are those brackets coming, Mike?
They're terrible. I have six teams remaining in my Sweet 16.
Ouch.
Get this. I've picked a perfect East regional to this point. So four of the teams that I have left are going to knock one another out.
You're not losing any money on this, are you?
$5, man. But I'm losing a lot of face in front of my extended family.
It's a contribution. That's what it is.
I just keep telling them I'm a baseball guy.
I'm in third place in my office pool, so I'm feeling pretty good about myself.
Nice.
Contributor to the G.I. Joe Club Collectors Club newsletter, and he's admin of GeneralJoes.com. Also joining us is Justin. How you doing, Justin?
Not too bad, Gary. How you doing?
Good, good. I saw your Catamounts won their first round game and then promptly were exited in the next...
Yeah, they got a bad break with North Carolina and got soundly trounced, so it's...
North Carolina has a very, very soft way right now, because I think the next they're playing is Ohio, is that right?
I think that's right, yes.
Expect to see UNC at least in the Elite Eight, so.
Yep.
Justin, what is a catamount?
Catamount is like a mountain lion.
Mountain lion. Why can't you just call it a mountain lion?
Because it's Vermont.
I was thinking it was like a saddle for a mountain lion or something. I thought it was something cool. like something a monkey could ride.
That's how I get to work every morning.
Something He-Man throws on the battle cat.
Yeah, something like that.
It's the catamount.
That'd be pretty badass. I like that idea.
You ride a mountain lion to work, Justin?
I kill a couple bears. And
stick your head in the stream and pull a trout out with your teeth. There you go.
That's breakfast, yeah.
That's what they call McDonald's up there. It's a trout with arches on it.
There you go.
Hey, Justin, I saw that you front page Chuck.
I did. I took mercy on him, gave him a little front page. I don't know if it gave him any hits or not. I did do that for him.
Chuck, what's the traffic report of the front paging there?
I actually haven't checked yet. I was going to wait to talk about that until the shout-out section.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my God.
All right.
How do you not know, man?
Well, he just did it. And, you know, it's not like I check every day like Deranged Psycho.
Oh, that disappoints me, Chuck.
Okay, we got a packed night. Chuck, let's go ahead and start it off with tonight's first very special guest.
Thank you, Gary. In the world of animation, there are men, there are myths, there are legends, but only one of them is Flint Dilly.
He's a mouse.
The incomparable Flint Dilly.
That's funny. Well, it's good to be here, guys. So we're in Joe Land tonight, huh?
Absolutely. Big time Joe Land. We are Joe fanatics.
All right. Yeah, because I haven't been in Joe World for a while. I've been doing a lot in Transformer World now as far as my back the 80s world. But I want to do another G.I. Joe project one of these days. I don't know whether it's a comic book or it's a show or what it is. But yeah, I want to revisit Joe again.
I think I speak for most folks when I say we would love to have you revisit Joe again. That'd be very cool.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know what they're doing with Joe. Is there any Joe animation happening next year? I mean, I know there's the movie coming out.
Yeah.
What's your feeling about it? Because I saw the trailer. It looked kind of interesting. And then my son told me that there was a rumor Flint was getting killed, in which case, you know, then now it's a jihad.
No. Flint, we believe Flint will be okay.
Oh, Duke good. Is the one. Duke is the one being killed, supposedly.
Yeah, well, he was always worthless anyway. So
yeah, there we go.
Just from an extremely biased. Do not trust anything you hear from me. But anyway, yeah. No, I spent most of my career on G.I. Joe, and you can kind of see it in the old episodes, you know, where, like, you know, I'd be elevating Flint every opportunity I got, and then the other editors, you know, have him in there, you know, peeling potatoes and stuff like that, you know.
Nothing wrong with that. We're all big Flint fans, I think.
So, no, it's kind of funny. And the other thing, you know, the closest thing to G.I. Joe I've written in a long time is I have a movie coming out this summer. It's a direct-to-DVD Starship Troopers Invasion.
Oh,
and what's really funny is, you know, when I was writing those guys, it was a lot like writing G.I. Joe. Now it is, I believe, an R-rated movie. It's an anime, but you know, nevertheless, it's kind of the closest I've done to that in a long time.
That's awesome. I love Starship Troopers. That'll be a good thing to keep an eye out for.
Definitely. Oh yeah, no, it's they just released a trailer. I think it's on the net on the web. They just released a trailer at Worldcon because I was there signing copies of signing a digital comic book. How's that? Yeah, you know, I kept writing on people's iPads, and they go. But Chris Metz and I were signing our Transformer Autocracy digital comic book.
Excellent. I've heard some good things about that.
Let me put it this way. It's been a party to do that because, you know, it was first time. Well, I wrote the first Bayformers video game.
Yeah.
But other than that, you know, it was the first real Transformer. And I was working on another one that never saw the light of day. And then I've done some consulting on the Jagex game, which could be really good.
Cool.
But, you know, I hadn't really done sort of original Transformer work in a while. And this is set in, I mean, it could be almost a backstory for G1 as matter of fact, that's what I kind of think of it as being. But, you know, it's set a million years ago, so it doesn't trape over old ground or anything. And it was kind of an opportunity to go back and sort of explain some things that were never explained before. And that would be fun to do with G.I. Joe. Yeah, because they're
very cool.
New thing to do with Joe.
First of all, I love the fact that you refer to the movie Transformers as Bayformers. That's awesome. That makes me very happy.
Well, that's a call it in you know, out here in Transformer world, because you know, you have G1 and then you have all the different comic book iterations, then you have all the different animated, you know, you have Armada and you have, you know, and then the movies are just called Bayformers. But that was almost that was sort of what the way the art directors referred to it, you know, just as, you know, yeah, we're doing a Bayformer style, you know. And so it was almost like a technical term. It wasn't like anybody was being pejorative or anything.
Gotcha.
It's just kind of a technical term for that style.
Makes sense. Mm. And I know you asked about G.I. Joe Animation. That's a somewhat sore subject because they had a really excellent series last year called G.I. Joe Renegades that was actually going alongside the first season of Transformers Prime. And Transformers Prime has been extended now to 2 and 3 seasons, and G.I. Joe Renegades got kind of unsummarily axed after season number one.
Was there something wrong with it, or is it doing bad?
No, it had the second highest ratings of the Hub Network.
Yeah, the prevailing thought is that they wanted to get the quote-unquote universes in line with the movie, and so they got rid of the animation and are thinking about revisiting animation after the movie comes out, that type of thing. But it was the Renegades animated series had very good ratings. It was critically acclaimed. It had a great staff of writers and voice actors, and it was a really excellent series, but unfortunately it suffered the blow of Hollywood and Paramount, we think.
Yeah, no, that's really too bad, you know, because the, you know, I mean, yeah, certainly Batman has proved you can have multiple iterations of anything on Transformers, for that matter. You don't have to line everything up with the movie, and nor do you want to.
Exactly.
You know, because either you get stuck in this position where if they make a change in the movie, you know, you have to follow that, or you end up in this position where you can't really make anything happen because you don't want to somehow break the movie. And that's really much more of an impediment. And, you know, it's like with Batman, I mean, you know, you can turn on the TV and I can see everything from Adam West to, you know, Dark Knight to Batman Brave and Bold to the, you know, Paul Dini, Bruce Timm, you know.
I think what helps Batman is Batman, he always looks like Batman from the comic book Adam West all the way through up into the Dark Knight. I mean, you know Batman, you look at him, you see a silhouette, and whether it's Adam West or the Dark Knight, you know it's Batman pretty much. And
correct.
The same thing with Optimus Prime. He's always going to transform to the truck. With Joe, you have the movie Duke, which is nothing like the comic Duke or the cartoon Duke, and I believe that they're concerned about confusing the average parent that's buying this toy for the kid. You know, I don't know, is this the movie Duke? Is this the cartoon Duke? Is they can't get it all in a line for Joe for some reason, but they can do it for the other lines. I think it's kind of a stab to the collector base for basically saying, well, we don't think really that the average person out there is smart enough to figure out multiple Dukes, so we're just going to take it down and simplify it for everyone else. But all the while, you could have 3 Optimus Primes and 4 different Batmans out there in different uniforms, but you know they're Batman.
I'm with you. I just don't get it. I mean, it seems to me that certainly with G.I. Joe, I mean, you know, Duke, you have any guy in a green uniform with blonde hair and fairly light skin, and you tell us his name's Duke twice, and I get it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those guys have very signature costumes, and you just live with the franchise signature. Even think about Batman. Now, granted, Batman is much more stylized than the average G.I. Joe character, but people still get it. James Bond, you have blonde guys play him, you have dark-haired guys play him, you have old guys play him, you have young guys play him. Everyone knows it's James Bond.
And Joe has that with Snake Eyes.
Well, I would argue you have that with Cobra Commander, you have that with you have that with Snake Eyes. You have it, and you can have it with all sorts of characters that I don't even know where they use them anymore, but they're kind of good characters, and you could bring them back. Tomax and Zamot and those kind of guys. I mean, Scarlet, okay. Mm-hmm. Give any woman red hair and a bow and arrow, and it's Scarlet, Yep. And you just don't worry about it. I mean, you either have signature characters or you don't, or you say, okay, we're going to do something else, and we're going to limit the show to a set of characters that won't trip over the movie, and people get used to that after 10 minutes, because the thing with G.I. Joe is it was always fun that way. You know what I mean? The idea with G.I. Joe is that, you have a lot of characters and you have different ones in every adventure. And that's one thing, interestingly enough, that I think you can get away with G.I. Joe that would be harder with Transformers is I think you could, have your G.I. Joe elite team and that's who your show is about. And you bring in the other guys every once in a while, but if they're really worried about breaking the movie.
Yeah, and you bring up some good points about quote-unquote breaking the movie, just because I've always kind of wondered that same thing. Why do you want the cartoon and the movie to all be in the same universe? Because, like you said, you can't do one without it affecting the other, and it's weird bringing up, that made me think of the Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon that's coming out in April, and they're also going to be releasing a comic book to kind of go alongside it, and I just wonder how stuff like that operates independently with each other, where you don't want to do anything too drastic in one without potentially impacting the other, so why not just let them exist in their own universe?
I think 20 years ago, when the marketplace was very simple and the characters are normally defined by their live-action counterpart or their comic book, which had a very small market, I could see an argument for worrying about making consistent universes. Now, I mean, just looking at any property I can think of, I just can't even imagine what the argument is. Viewers are very sophisticated now, and fans are even more sophisticated. And, they get it. I mean, seriously, when you have Brave and Bold, where it is a goofy comedy that's kind of an homage to early 80s cartoons, coming out the same season as The Dark Knight, and nobody gets confused, nobody gets upset. Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody gets a joke. I mean, what boundary is there anymore? I got to be honest. I totally don't get it. And I usually don't like to be this crabby in interviews, but I was just. but serious. I mean, it's like that made a lot of sense in a 1985 marketplace, for instance.
Yep.
In 2012, there can be 10 different G.I. Joes, and nobody will be confused.
We agree. We're crabby with you.
Yep. Even if you go back to the 1985 marketplace, I don't remember the comic book and the cartoon having anything to do with one another, and people got along just fine.
I mean, probably bad behavior on both sides, and I don't remember it particularly with G.I. Joe, but yeah, I mean, no, there was a lot of, we definitely took our cues from Larry Hama's work, certainly, and from guys at Hasbro, and they sent, they'd send the model sheets, and they designed the toys and all that, but as far as coordinating continuity or something, I mean, it was quite enough just to get, 65 episodes out in a year, much less trying to coordinate with the comic book, and they're different mediums. They should have a different purpose, and as far as you're not violating certain franchise...
Snake Eyes talking?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you have certain rules for characters, and there's certain things that are consistent within the franchise, and beyond that, who cares? It certainly shouldn't be any reason to slow down any train. Because, everything's going to find its fan. And the other thing is, if you're making a movie and the movie bombs, you don't want to be stuck into a TV show that follows that movie. Because A, the movie probably did something wrong, and B, it was perceived as a failure, certainly in the marketplace, with sponsors and stuff like that, and it really hurts your show. Whereas if you go out and do a show that's its own take on it, they just exist on parallel tracks. And I mean, this is a particular cross that, axe I grind, because I've done a lot of video games that are adaptations of movies. And the truth is, a video game is at least an 8 to 12 hour experience, and a movie is at most a 2 hour experience.
Right.
And, and very little of the movie is actually something you can make into a video game. So you've got to go outside of the movie. Batman, again, Arkham Asylum is not the universe of Dark Knight, nor is it the universe of Brave and Bold or any other universe. It's some kind of composite universe, and everybody seems to be perfectly happy with it. I'll stop ranting anytime.
No,
you want.
No,
we love it. We love it. Yeah. Bring it on. Yeah.
We're thinking about maybe kicking Chuck off and getting you on every week.
No.
I mean, Chuck, you know the guy that would really kick off would be Justin, so he's just more sensitive about it.
No, Mike, maybe you should look.
I don't know. I've only seen four windows up, and I mean, you may not have to kick anybody off, just make the show longer.
Hey, there you go.
that's usually never a problem for us.
We do have some questions.
Sure. I will answer everything I can remember. Okay, you know, and then I'll make stuff up if I can't.
No problem. We've had guests do that before, but it's just some of the stuff you've already covered, which is good. But we're going to start off real easy. How did you get started writing in general and then make the transition to doing cartoons?
I guess if you got really back to the ultimate beginning, a friend of mine, when I was in seventh grade, this friend of mine started writing a novel, and it was really cool. So I decided, hey, I think I'll start writing a novel. And I really liked doing it. I never finished it. I probably only made like 20 pages in. But the point is, I kind of had the bug. And then I took a few creative writing classes in high school, and they all went horribly. I mean, it was really funny because, I was thinking about that one time I was on a panel, and they were asking me that same question. That was kind of funny. I mean, there was absolutely nothing, certainly in high school, that would have indicated to anybody, A, that I had any talent, and B, I'd ever become employed doing that, or, you know, that there was any promise whatsoever. So nobody should get discouraged because, I mean, it was downright, I mean, I think downright vicious creative writing teachers. Let's see what happened after that. Then college. Yeah, I was majoring in ancient history and I was at Berkeley, and we didn't have really any writing department. Oh, I double majored in ancient history and rhetoric, but my official degree was in ancient history. And then finally I got out of college, but my college girlfriend and I had started writing a novel. Actually finished it, never sold it, but that was really cool. And I felt, okay, I want to keep doing that stuff. And then I went to film school. I really had no idea what to do with my life. So I went to film school and, for grad school and at USC. And I started writing screenplays and decided, yeah, I really like this. But as far as animation, it had never crossed my mind to write animation. I mean, that's just life plays its funny little tricks. And the first person that ever offered to hire me to write anything was Joe Ruby at Ruby Spears. And, you know, I went in there and I was in development. Frankly, I didn't even know what development meant. That meant you're creating, new TV shows for the next season. And I kind of was good at it, and I really liked doing it. And so, I found myself in the animation business. And then, so I worked on things like Mr. T, and I'm trying to remember what else I wrote. I think I wrote The Puppy. And then a couple years later, Steve Gerber, who'd been a story editor at Ruby Spears, called me up and said, hey, you want to come work on G.I. Joe? And his big pitch was, you could hit people with real fists because, in those days in TV animation, you had these... It was just it was the beginning of really amok political correctness. And it was like if you had your character in the water and he gets hit by a wave, that was like one violence point.
Wow.
Yeah, and if he acted like it hurt, you were probably up to 10. And you only got so many violence points, and you couldn't save them all up. And you couldn't just, like, have it really passive and then have somebody, disemboweled or anything. It didn't work that way. But so G.I. Joe was this, like, radical new thing where you couldn't hit anybody. And these guys were the worst shots in the world. But, you couldn't, shoot anybody and kill them or anything. But you could actually, have fights and... have guns. You couldn't have guns in Saturday morning TV. And I loved it, and so it just kind of went from there. But yeah, Steve Gerber was story editing the show, and this was really early on. And he'd just gotten behind, and I'd had a disastrous experience at Lucasfilm. And so he just called me up, and I came in and started story editing. So that's how I got on G.I. Joe.
Very cool. I know we're a G.I. Joe Central podcast, but I kind of wanted to branch out just a little bit with one of my questions here.
Sure.
One of my favorite 80s properties was actually Visionaries.
Oh, yeah.
I really loved the way kind of magic and technology interacted with each other. Now, how did you feel about working on that series? Did it feel like it was kind of a little bit ahead of its time, or was...
Visionaries, it was a very special show in a lot of different ways. Visionaries was the last Sunbow show that I worked on. And so it was kind of bittersweet, it was a toy line where, I think actually the toy line was canceled before the show actually aired. So there was this kind of sense of doom about Visionaries, a sense it was the end of Sunbow and, frankly, one of the most fun periods of, I think anybody who worked at Sunbow, one of the most fun periods of their life. But also it was Tokyo Movie Shinsha, TMS, did the animation, and they really wanted to prove themselves, and I thought it was just a great looking show.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's, you know, it came along, it simultaneously was the hardest show to birth, in the sense that, you know, G.I. Joe, by the time I got there, we knew what the show was. You know, I think Steve and I thought of it as being much more kind of like, you know, James Bond with a whole lot of characters. Whereas in the beginning, it had been much more straight ahead military. We thought of it as much more like a counterterrorist squad. Mm-hmm. But other than that, there wasn't, you know, 5 degrees of difference between how any of us perceived the show. And everybody got it. And when I came, this is a roundabout way of answering your visionary's questions, because just to give you a context.
Sure.
And then I got into Transformers when they felt that the show they had was too young, and it was competing with a show called GoBots, and they really wanted to distinguish it and make it a lot older. And they just thought I'd been their edgiest writer on G.I. Joe, so they wanted to put me on Transformers for a while, just to kind of, you know, make it nastier or something. Make it older, really. And then there was Inhumanoids, which is a whole story all to itself. And then Visionaries came along, and I remember the birthing process on Visionaries was really tough. That was the only time there were a lot of fights between the comic book guys and the TV guys. And not really, they didn't really directly concern me, other than the comic book guys had a very set down idea of how they wanted to do the show, and we had just developed it a different way. And we really didn't have a lot of time to go back and redevelop it, and we liked our ideas and they liked their ideas. And I remember there was just kind of a tough meeting in New York during Toy Fair of, I guess, what would have to be 1996. It could be 1997. And sort of everybody went their own ways. They did their, you know, their visionary. No, actually, that's not what happened. I think the actual Marvel comic book was an adaptation of the pilot for the show. But I could be wrong about that, but that is what I believe happened. But anyway, so Visionaries, you know, that was a show where, I mean, I think I outlined every episode and wrote probably, you know, 8 out of 12 of them and edited all of them. I mean, I just felt like kind of like the last guy left in the shop when we were doing Visionaries. As a matter of fact, we'd closed our West Coast office by the time I finished it, because I remember I was writing at home at that point. And so it was kind of just me and Jay Bacall and Joe and Tom from Sunbow. And then there's good staff at TMS. We had a producer, Karu, who knew for a long time after that. A lot of good people. And it was a whole different exercise, you know, where we were really hammering out the show. So, yeah. So, you know, Visionaries was, and also, too, I think all of us were just at the absolute peak of our powers. We had done, I mean, think about it, with G.I. Joe and Transformers, and those were the only, Inhumanoids, and a weird obscure show called Muscle Machines. I mean, we'd produced probably, I'd say, 200 half hours, and, you know, in like 2.5 years. I mean, that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And we sort of knew Visionaries was the end, and we all really loved the show, and we knew we had a great animation company. So, you know, Visionaries was just kind of this really great swan song. And what's really funny is I was probably near the end of writing it. I remember Jay Bacall called me up and said that, you know, to go see this movie called Princess Bride. He said, yeah, you'll see the 14th Visionaries. And he was right. I mean, because Visionaries, we wanted to walk this line of making it fun and, you know, kind of fanciful. And the other thing that influenced Visionaries a lot, and I didn't really realize it as much at the time, because when you're actually living your life, you're not noticing your influences. But I was doing a lot of work with Gary Gygax, who's the creator of Dungeons & Dragons. I was designing games at that point, too. And so, obviously, Dungeons & Dragons influenced me a whole lot with that. And that whole sword and sorcery world. And so it was really kind of the culmination of a whole era of my life. And so I've kind of a real fondness for Visionaries. So, yeah, Dungeons & Dragons definitely sort of played into that. And, you know, frankly, it made it into stuff like Joe. I mean, stuff like Skeletons in the Closet and all that had serious Lovecraft D&D type overtones. Yeah, but anyway, yeah, so Visionaries was kind of the swan song, and everybody knew it, and it was a very exciting period. And a lot of things worked right to make Visionaries happen.
That's really cool. I have to say, you know, I did actually have at least one of the Visionary figures. So it was something I always found it interesting, but it wasn't like the line that really didn't grab me. Plus, unfortunately, the cartoon, I remember only seeing like a couple episodes of it, but then my local syndicator dropped it.
It is a very, very obscure show. I don't even know that it's ever really been rerun, probably, but I just don't know. I have English versions of it on disc. I mean, I could probably get other ones now. No, I mean, you know, Visionaries had
a lot of things working against it. But I quite honestly, I think of it as kind of one of these little jewels that, you know, it's just kind of an obscure thing that, you know, somebody will stumble on one day. I mean, because it was very much, the episodes were very much linked together and it had a strong continuity and you sort of had to see all of them to get it. It was a very weird, obscure show, you know, and the toys themselves were, you know, kind of odd. They're based on, you know, holograms, you know, where you had an animal and a symbol and all that. But, you know, somehow, as I said, my subjective memory of it is very pleasant.
Well, I mean, people can go on Amazon now. I know that, I was going to say not that long ago, but it's actually been about 10 years. They did release a complete set on DVD of the Visionaries with, you know, special features and all that stuff. And I think it's even a holographic box.
I'll have to track that down. You know, because, like, I only knew about that stuff if somebody called me up and wanted me to talk on it or be interviewed for it. And that never happened with Visionaries or in Humanoids, which, oddly enough, were the shows that were just kind of really my shows.
Well, it's funny you mentioned in Humanoids, and this is actually, maybe we can take a little sidetrack. When we interviewed Buzz Dixon, and he had mentioned that there actually was some idea to connect a lot of the Sunbow cartoons, G.I. Joe, Transformers,
yes.
Gem, My Little Inhumanoids, and all that. And it's like, I just want to get your take on that.
Oh, it was very much something we were doing. I mean, with that era, you have to understand that what was really unique about that staff and that point in time was you could never have done that ever before because the shows were so dominated by networks and it was so much about political agendas and so little about just creative people having fun. But with Sunbow, we had so many episodes and there was very little adult supervision. And as a matter of fact, I'd say almost none at all. And that includes Joe and Tom and Hasbro was just great. And we brought in a lot of guys who were comic book guys. And so the comic book guys, I was much more of a game guy beyond being an animation writer. The comic book guys just sort of brought with them genetically the idea of continuities and of crossovers and of shared worlds and all that. So you'll find one fan at BotCon last year gave me a really interesting poster he had made of all the appearances of a character named Hector Ramirez, who appeared in G.I. Joe, Transformers, and in Humanoids. I don't think we ever found out how to get him into Visionaries. And I think he even appeared on Bigfoot. And he might have appeared on Gem. And he was our Geraldo Rivera, kind of a reporter who was always, you know, it didn't matter what show he was on, he was always going to get beat up or, you know, something bad always happened to him. And what you have to remember, Geraldo was a wildly different guy back in 1986 than he is now. I mean, now he's kind of this guy on Fox News, and he's sort of a reputable guy. Back then, he had this TV show where he had Nazis throwing chairs around. And
got his nose broken.
Yeah, he was trying to open up Al Capone's, you know, vault, and a big bottle came falling out, and so much for the secret Al Capone treasure. And, you know, he's this kind of goofy character. Modern geopolitical events would be in there. Muammar Gaddafi made some appearances, certainly, in Transformers, and I think in G.I. Joe, too. Yeah, and so there, you know, and it was the fundamental 80s-ness of that whole experience was significant, too. But what you had, so you had a bunch of comic book guys who couldn't believe they were out there really writing TV shows and getting paid real dollars. And then you had a bunch of animation guys feeling like they'd been let out of jail from the networks. And you had, to a person, you know, and I can think of almost no exceptions, with all the writers and producers and everybody involved really wanted to make great shows and I'm not just saying that. I mean, it was really true. There was I never once got the feeling anybody just like didn't care. There were episodes that just never got to be what we wanted them to be. And there were times the animation just didn't come back and we were dealing with ridiculous schedules and we always felt like we couldn't ever get everything fixed. But I mean, as far as the writing and art team, I mean, there were absolutely sincere, you know, dedicated people, just exactly the right people in the right time in the right place in the right circumstances. I mean, it was really a magical period.
All right. I'm gonna turn it back to being a little bit more Joe-centric here, Flint.
Sure.
Obviously, I mean, the main, you know, the second in command of the Joe team is named after you.
Right. That was their job. The job that said, hey, we named a character after you.
So how'd you pull that off?
No, here's the deal. I don't know that it was, he was really named after me. It's certainly possible that, but that's what they were saying at the time. And so I just chose to believe it and then, you know, and make him my character, you know, as much as I could. But, I edited and, you know, did, you know, many episodes that he didn't appear in. But yeah, it's really cool. I'm sitting here looking at my original G.I. Joe Flint doll framed on my wall here. So that was really cool. But that's the kind of thing you could do then. I mean, Shipwreck was Buzz Dixon. I mean, yeah, Buzz is. I mean, he, oddly enough, Buzz looked more like Gung Ho, but he was. Right,
switch the hat out. Nobody will notice.
Yeah, he just wrote the character. I mean, you know, he wrote the character. He loved the character, and that was kind of his guy. And so, even if it was an episode I was writing or editing, you know, into Buzz, hey, why don't you write some Shipwreck lines? And there was a real quality. It wasn't a sense of a lot of authorship. I mean, and that's not to say the writers didn't do the whoever's credited on the script usually did the heavy lifting. But there was a real sense this is a show, and if Buzz really writes, you know, Shipwreck, well, you know, we want him to look at their Shipwreck lines. It's not about, you know, who gets credit or any of that stuff. So that was a really kind of cool thing about it too.
So why was Flint such a near and dear character to you? You know, there's that interview that's out there that Marv Wolfman attached himself to Quick Kick, and we did get to talk to Buzz earlier, and he gave us just all kinds of stuff about why Shipwreck appealed to him. Why did Flint strike such a chord?
Okay, first of all, his voice wasn't British. I always thought of as being British, not that I'm British, but I'm just kind of an Anglophile. I just kind of like the character. I mean, what I liked about him is that he seemed, as I said, we always thought of the show as kind of being, you know, James Bond with a lot of guys, in that we didn't want it to get heavily military, and it could have gone that way very easily. We wanted it to be, you know, they really are this kind of cool counterterrorism force, and they take on anything that comes their way, because it would have gotten tired after a few episodes if everything was a battle. And so, you know, he kind of became my character. I just liked Lady J. I liked the fact that he had a girlfriend. I always liked getting female characters into the show, even though we knew they didn't, you know, they didn't sell as well. But, you know, you look at another sort of late 70s, 80s phenomenon was the Village People, and we didn't want the show to look like, you know, some gay all-male cast. Not that I have anything against gay people. I just, you know, that we didn't want it to be that. So it was nice having a character that had a girlfriend in there. We liked to get the Baroness in there as much as we could and kind of, set her up with Cobra Commander. It just sort of seemed to show, it gave the show some breath. So he was an easy character to work that way with that way. He seemed kind of like an officer kind of character, and you needed that in G.I. Joe because you had Duke. And Duke, to me, always seemed like a really good kind of sergeant, whereas Flint seemed like a guy that actually could have gone in and taken a briefing from one of the higher-up guys. And we didn't have that. You know, there weren't a lot of ranked characters in there. And so, that's kind of how I envisioned the character. And the other thing that happened, other than my own narcissism, is that, in that period, there were certain characters they emphasized and certain characters they didn't emphasize. And about the time I got on, he was an emphasized character. We would get faxes every week, and it would say, you know, please include, take your pick of any three characters, you know, usually obscure, you know, please include Ace and Gung Ho and Roadblock, and we're discontinuing, you know, Ashtray and Corn Dog and Spittoon. And, you know, so you take Ashtray, well, Corn Dog and Spittoon. I bet you guys don't remember those characters.
Spittoon really, he didn't sell well at all.
Yeah, Spittoon just wasn't making it in the market. But because the other thing that's really interesting that you kind of don't really think about looking back is that at the time we had no idea that there was even going to be Duke or Flint or any of these guys next season. You know, what we thought of it is they come out with three new characters every week and they discontinue three, and G.I. Joe is just this team. And while we developed affections for specific characters, it wasn't like we thought, oh, okay, there's this handful of characters we have to use, and you know, they're the core characters, and then everybody else is a bit player. I mean, you know, like anything just sort of evolves that way for a variety of reasons. Some characters are officers, you tend to use them more because you need them in there. Some characters are brought on late. You know, sometimes they caught on, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes you had characters that, because we would have characters you're supposed to emphasize, but then whoever else you wanted to use was kind of your choice. And, you know, guys, ninja stuff was really big then, so all of a sudden you had Snake Eyes as, you know, was a much bigger character than he would have been 5 years earlier or 5 years later. Cobra Commander, you know, I just thought Chris Latta was just great and really brilliant. I used every opportunity to get him into the recording studio because he gave us a signature sound, really, with both Joe and Transport, with all of our shows, that made us different than the other shows on the air. I mean, there's a legitimate kind of craziness to that character that you didn't often get on animation in the 80s. So did I answer your question? I've kind of rambled here.
No, that is good, and that's actually, that's kind of a neat segue in that we've kind of heard through the grapevine that you were close with him, and a lot of times those are the characters that he voiced are the ones that everybody remembers and has this real great connection with.
I mean, he was a wild, raw, crazy guy, but he was really brilliant, and I really liked the guy. But, I mean, he was crazy. He did stand up. Yeah, I mean, you know, in the sense that a lot of the voice actors in those days were either celebrities who'd kind of come do this, just, you know, Casey Kasem, who they just viewed, you know, this is kind of an addition to their paycheck, or they just kind of did voice work on the side, or they're in a cadre of professional, you know, animation voices. And they were on every show, and some of them, you know, like, you know, Frank Welker's the obvious case of, you know, somebody who's just transcendently brilliant. I mean, you wouldn't believe what that guy could do with his voice. And then a lot of them were just kind of in the club, and they were all good. There was a reason they were in the club. But then there were these guys, you know, I think Arthur Burghardt would fall into that category, Chris Latta. A lot of characters were people that Joe and Tom had discovered in New York, or they'd used in commercials, or they'd seen at stand-up clubs. And Chris had a stand-up show. And so every once in a while, we go down to the comedy club in L.A., and, you know, you're on Sunset Strip at midnight hearing Chris's show, and it was a very different fare than we were hearing from Cobra Commander. But he was like, stand-ups are the, you know, the berserker frontline troops of the entertainment industry, and he was one of those guys.
You know, Flint, I'm not sure if you're the right guy to ask. I should have asked Buzz, but one thing I've always wondered about Shipwreck is around the time that G.I. Joe was, the cartoon was popular, there was a daytime soap opera called Days of Our Lives, and there was a character named Bo Brady who happened to be a sailor. He was part of the Merchant Marines, and a lot of his character traits, he was played by an actor named Peter Reckles, I noticed in Shipwreck. Was that something that was done on purpose, or is it just one of these funny coincidences, and, you know, have I just lost my pan card?
No, do not trust my answer to this question. I certainly didn't know anything about that. I had a high school girlfriend that watched Days of Our Lives, so I was a little bit aware of the show, but not the character, and that was, you know, also many years earlier. But my sense is, if there was a character model for that character when we started, because a lot of characters started out with like a famous actor character model, but then by the third time you've written him, he's all of a sudden he's your guy and you forget all of that stuff and he just morphs into something else. I mean, and I think his was Jack Nicholson, and if I had to guess, it would be Jack Nicholson from Five Easy Pieces. Remember, he was a sailor in that?
I hate to admit it, but I've never seen that movie.
Oh, well, yeah, I would strongly recommend, even if for nothing other than understanding G.I. Joe, I would strongly recommend that you get in touch with your inner 70s, and there are probably about 10 movies to watch that would explain a lot of things to you, and one of them is probably Five Easy Pieces. I would take a hard look at, I'm trying to think of what else, what other shows, I thought of James Bond as being the Sean Connery movies, which is sort of also how I thought of Flint, not that I think of myself as being Sean Connery. Yeah, I'd take a look at those. I'm trying to think what else was influencing us at that point, because, you know, I mean, there was a lot. Obviously, Star Wars influenced all entertainment for a decade after its first release. Raiders of the Lost Ark, but less so. I'm trying to think of what other action films. You know, anything by Clint Eastwood. Any of the Dirty Harrys, even though we didn't really have a Dirty Harry Clint Eastwood character in there. Combat, it's a 60s show, but it's well worth seeing for no other reason than it really sort of set the vibe for any kind of a show with military guys in it for a long time to come after that. It was Vic Morrow. But and it's, you know, I think it's easy to get. If you ever just get kind of interested and say, okay, we, you know, where did this stuff come from? Because everything comes from somewhere. I would take a hard look at a movie called Where Eagles Dare. Was certainly very influential with me. It's a really good film. It may play slow now, but just put on your old movie glasses. It had Clint Eastwood, a young Clint Eastwood, and Richard Burton in it. It was basically about a big siege on a Nazi fortress on the top of a mountain. And that's what passed as a real good suspense action thriller in those days. Because, you know, action movies were different. Bullet, Steve McQueen movie. I put in your inner 70s. I mean, I've never talked about this before, but you just asked a really interesting question. And that was that you sort of look partly at what was going on at the time, and then partly looking at what everybody that watched wrote that stuff grew up watching, because everybody always recapitulates their youth. All Avengers are other things to look at. The Prisoner, big time. The Prisoner was hugely influential, Steve Gerber and I. The whole Smithville, the Springfield episodes, they were all Prisoner. I mean, that was hugely influential.
I am a huge Buck Rogers fan. I watched the series back in the 80s with Gil Gerard, and it kind of even goes back farther into my family. My dad remembers going to see the Buck Rogers serials in the movie theaters when he was growing up in New York City. What kind of Buck Rogers do you subscribe to? Do you subscribe to the William Buck Rogers type of guy, or do you subscribe to the Buck Rogers as Buck Rogers the hero type of guy?
I got to tell you, for all the questions people have asked me about Buck Rogers, nobody's ever asked me that one before, and I never really thought about it before. Well, it's funny. Yeah, I mean, Buck Rogers is really weird, and it's interesting to talk about it in the context of this stuff, because it's kind of strange that, yeah, I could have Buck Rogers and, have it in my family and, have the rights and all that, and done all the franchises that I've done in my life. And what's funny about Buck Rogers to me is to me, there are five distinctly different iterations of Buck Rogers. And one of the first one is, 1929, if you go back to the old comic strips. And that's what everybody kind of starts with and everybody fixates on. And that is guy from the 20th century who goes, who in suspended animation, who goes 25th century. And he has a number of adventures. And what's interesting about Buck Rogers is you never really figure out quite what he is. I mean, it sort of starts out being a war thing where you're fighting the hands. But what's funny about that, and what's deceptive, tell me if this gets boring, but questions. What's funny about that, and what's deceptive about that with the character, is that, basically, he doesn't get off the earth. It's not until they get rid of the war stuff and the post-apocalyptic stuff and all that, and Buck Rogers gets off the earth, that he becomes really what Buck Rogers is, and that is a space guy. Okay, I mean, that's how I think of him. I think it was a guy with a rocket ship and a jetpack who goes to weird planets and fights sort of villains, but I don't see it as being Star Wars. There isn't some evil empire out there. It's a much more chaotic world. I see the world as being kind of like our world around the time of the Revolutionary War, where they're pirates and they're multiple different countries and they're sort of distant empires and they're all fighting with each other and there are unexplored areas and all that. I see Buck Rogers as existing in that world. So, in one adventure, he's kind of working for a police force or a paramilitary force, and the next adventure he's out trying to find the lost planetary mine on Io off of Jupiter, and the one after that he's dealing with corrupt guys running a casino somewhere in the asteroid belt. I'm being silly, but you get what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
And so anyway, so the first iteration of Buck Rogers, he was sort of all of those. He was just this guy on a long unending adventure, and you really never knew what his job was. Yeah, and he would sort of be working for the Earth Defense Org and all that, but next thing you know, he's making his own rocket ship. I mean, what everybody forgets about the original Buck Rogers is he actually built the rocket ship that he first went into space on, that he was kind of an inventor. That's a little bit what we lost with the Gil Gerard, where he seemed like kind of a dumb flyboy most of the time. And that's not to say,
military guy, yeah.
Yeah, that's not to say Gil Gerard was a dumb flyboy, but I mean, they definitely, and there always were strong scientist characters, and Buck was never that. So there's that iteration of Buck Rogers, and the serials that you were referring to are kind of a subset of that iteration. They're the Buster Crab serials, which are well worth seeing. Then you go to the post-World War II Buck Rogers, and that's the stuff that's imitated in a lot of things like Futurama, a lot of video games, everything from Ratchet and Clank to what was that one that came out? It looked really great. It was like Dark Void or something like that. I can't remember. But that's sort of the Atomopunk version of Buck Rogers. So that's the next iteration. The next one after that would be Gil Gerard. And, the 80s show, and kind of as an asterisk attached to that would be the New York Times continuity strip in that era. But, the Gil Gerard, Aaron Gray version of Buck Rogers. Then there's another one, which if you really wanted to get the closest to what I see it as being, and that is what we did with TSR back in the late 80s, early 90s. And that was a full Buck Rogers role-playing game world, and we had board games and comic books. Mm-hmm. And I even wrote a novella, and we had a bunch of, we had a whole Bible developed. We very much approached it the way Sunbow approached G.I. Joe, except there was no animated show. And that's probably the closest to it, you know, to what I'll probably always think of Buck Rogers as being. And then there's, you know, there's sort of the iteration that Dynamite Comics has been doing. But really, it's sort of whatever we do next is kind of the you know, the next thing to think about with Buck Rogers. That's the fifth iteration. And what I'm giving you are, you know, there are a lot of subdivisions in all these iterations, because like in the 50s, there were a number of different artists, different writers and stuff like that. And they all brought their own thing to it. But by and large, those are the basic Buck Rogerses. And then with any franchise in the world, you just say, well, you know, what bonds them all together? Well, I think you have Buck. I think you have Wilma. I think you have Killer Kane somewhere around. You have Ardala. You have Black Barney. You have Dr. Huer. You know, I don't know. Maybe we need to see Tweaky again.
Dr. Theopolis.
Yeah, and Dr. Theopolis.
Not Hawk.
Yeah, there are these whole, you know, this whole, you know, cast of characters, and what do you bring with? And what's funny about it is there's a whole Buck Rogers I would like to explore next, which is kind of like what we were talking about, what I was talking about. And that is, he's just this guy on a series of adventures. He doesn't, not fighting an evil empire, but it has to be science fiction. And that is, you know, it has to be. Yeah, and that's how Buck Rogers always was. There's a difference between Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon. Is they weren't saying any of this stuff was real, but the idea was the stuff in Buck Rogers is grounded in this is possible. You know, you didn't have Buck Rogers suddenly show up and be in King Arthur world. Yeah, because Alex Raymond suddenly felt like drawing King Arthur. It didn't work that way. Yeah, Buck Rogers was, you know, he is a science fiction guy in the 25th century, and part of the fun is just speculating on the future. And, you know, and the future should feel very human, but you want to have a lot of, you know, good robots and weird aliens and strange ships and off-world colonies and giant cities. And, yeah, you can have some, you know, large ambient bad guys, but you don't want to be Star Wars. So anyway, that's how that is my, you know, current thinking on Buck Rogers.
Interesting. Well, I love it. So thanks to your family.
Yeah. Well, if you get bored, take a look at some of the stuff we did in the 80s with TSR. There's actually very interesting stuff there.
Cool. I will definitely do that. Well, thanks a lot, Flint. We'll catch you later.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. All right,
thanks very much. Take it easy. Okay, we'd like to take a few minutes tonight to bring some folks in for a very special announcement. These three folks should be well known to everybody listening to this podcast. We've got Mark Chang and Joe Barbagallo from JJ Operation Red Retrieval. Mark directed the film and Joe starred as Beachhead. They are both joining forces with another person you are all extremely familiar with, Larry Hama, who is joining us as well. And we welcome them all to the show so they can make this very special announcement. We are quite honored they are joining us to do this tonight. So you guys take it away. Let us know what you got to tell us.
Great. Yay. Thanks for having us back. We're really excited. Always have fun when we're out here. We wanted to let you know that today is probably around the four month marker since we released Operation Red Retrieval. We've been relatively quiet since it launched, and part of that is because we've been talking about what we're about to announce right now, which is that Joe, myself, and Larry have met, have hit it off, and have been talking about making films, and we have just pretty much finalized our agreement to work on a feature film together.
Fantastic. Nice.
Excellent. Excellent. Tell us a little bit about the film, if you can, what you know so far.
Well, we've narrowed it down to two projects. The first one is a military science fiction script that I wrote titled Ghost Source Zero, set in a future where robot technology is prevalent and software advancements are at the brink of making artificial intelligence possible. So it's an original story. It follows a military police squad that's trying to track down and dismantle an organized crime syndicate responsible for cyber crimes, robot hacking, and assassinations. So we're excited about it. It's kind of like an Aliens plus Blade Runner with an anime feel.
Sounds awesome. Joe, right. Are you going to be working alongside Mark with this production, you said, right?
Yes, I will.
Are your fingers all grown back?
I will be doing whatever Mark asks of me.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I can't wait. There's a character in there that I really can't wait to play. Mark and I worked on a film project a while ago called Deployment Strategy, and this character, Warnock, kind of just took off, and you see this character back into this film, so I'm really excited for this film.
Excellent. Now, Larry, what are you bringing to the table? Are you doing some storyboarding? Are you polishing up the script a little bit? What are you hoping to get out of this?
That and more.
All right. Excellent.
Yeah, I'm looking to be involved on a lot of levels on this. I really like the Ghost Source Zero project, and I think it's got a lot of potential.
That's terrific.
Let's talk about another project.
Ooh, another project.
Larry, why don't you go ahead and talk about the next project, the second project?
Well, the second project is a novel that I wrote over 10 years ago that was never published. It was a Chinatown noir novel.
Nice.
Sort of ex-gang kid settled into a whole other existence and has to go back into a whole world that he sort of left behind and is involved with the Chinese organized crime and the mafia and corrupt cops and all sorts of neat stuff. Taking place in New York and New Jersey and Staten Island. Yeah, my agent sent it around at first. This was over 10. This was in the late 90s. You know, the publishers all said that nobody was in this genre. Nobody was interested in a novel with an Asian protagonist. Which I thought was kind of strange for the mystery genre, since I guess Charlie Chan and Mr. Moto don't count. But that's the way it all works. I mean, unless something fits it exactly into a slot in a genre,
yep.
People just don't want to take a chance on it. But I think the time has come around.
Yeah, we're really excited about it. You know, the backstory to this is that I had reached out to Larry when I was when the film was about to launch, Operation Red Retrieval, and sent him a copy of the movie. And we spoke after that and just started talking about movies and filmmaking. And I said, Larry, to be honest, I'll come right out and say I would love to work with you. We could figure out a way that made sense. And Larry seemed game. Why don't we have lunch together and chat about stuff? And we just spent the entire time, Joe, myself, and Larry, talking about action movies. And Larry had questions about our micro-budget approach to making Retrieval. And
I'm totally behind the whole micro-budget approach.
Yep.
For a lot of reasons. In my personal experience, the more money that's thrown at a project, the less control the creators have. So
that's a good point.
I think it's something that we want to keep manageable and within our control all the time. It's all a matter of what's more important to us.
So Larry, what'd you think of Operation Red Retrieval?
I loved it. Lots of times, I look at stuff and I'm sort of perplexed.
That's a good word.
So can you settle this bar bet for me, Larry, and tell me who would win, the Predator or Snake Eyes?
Let me put it this way. I mean, I tried all these years to watch the G.I. Joe animated series, the various ones, and I could never get beyond the first 10 or 20 seconds of any of them. And so my feeling about all the material is that, I don't know, it's also kind of personal to me, since all the characters are actually based on people I know. Mm-hmm. So, or new, so that, and I did that, the only reason I did that was so I could keep track of the characters.
But I know you told us last time you're on the show that it is sometimes difficult for you to watch on screen or in the cartoon. Well, the cartoon was always difficult to watch, but it was difficult to kind of read your characters done by other people or portrayed by other people in a movie. So it says something when you actually sat down and you actually liked Red Retrieval. So props to you, Mark Chang.
Yeah, thank you.
It just really struck me that way. It's because I'm more concerned about the characters being consistent than I am with the nuts and bolts of continuity. Uh-huh. Because I wrote every single issue pretty much panel by panel, page by page, without having any idea what was going to happen next. It was all about personality. Plots and the story points and things like that were all sort of, it was retconned day by day.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
A good example is the fact that I drew the Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow in issue 21, both having this hexagram tattoo on their forearms. But at that point, I had no idea why they both had that tattoo on their forearms, or what their relationship to each other was, how their past histories intersected. That all had to be sort of retcon, you know, five issues later.
It's awesome.
So, seeing what these guys did with the Red Retriever was really cool. You know, when, and as soon as I met Mark and Joe, I said, wow, you know, these guys sort of, you know, they get it. Cool. That's the main thing.
So do you find it somewhat refreshing to work on a film where you've got essentially a 2-hour window rather than a comic where you might have a run of 155 issues?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've written maybe 12, 14 scripts.
Sure.
I've only ever gotten one made, but I got paid for all of them.
There you go.
We're going to change that record.
And I've done a ton of script doctoring work. Mm-hmm. Which I think is, I find more comfortable to do in a lot of ways, because there's no pressure on me to like to come up with anything whole cloth.
Sure.
And people pay you well to like fix rotten stuff, you know. So. You know, as long as the check clears, I'm happy. You know, but that's the making the living part of life, you know.
Sure.
This is something, you know, that I'm really excited about on a very sort of creative level. So it's very different.
Terrific. And you're going to take, you guys are all going to take the same kind of micro-budget approach to this one that you did with Operation Red Retrieval? Or are you thinking about shopping it out to some larger scale production, or what's...
I think that is definitely a possibility. I mean, I think what Larry said is also really important. We three had more than one or two sit downs to talk about what's important to us here. And I think Larry, what he said before is absolutely correct, that this is really about, in terms of the scope, just maintaining creative control. The last time I was on, I talked a lot about the advantages fan films have over studio produced film, and that you're allowed to write the rules the way you want to write the rules. You know, the creator can do that. So I think that we three are going to try to do that with these two projects. We feel that that's really important. And if it has to be a micro budget for us to do that, then so be it.
That's the way it has to be, I think, because my personal experience has really taught me that. You know, if everybody involved gets it, you know, quote, gets it, unquote.
Yeah.
It makes it very... alleviates a lot of grief.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, I was hired to be a technical consultant on the first G.I. Joe movie, and that consisted really of a year of saying over and over again, no, Snake Eyes can't talk. And this was like a constant battle.
Oh, man.
Well, because some suit or some haircut had this brilliant creative idea that, wow, we have a character that can't speak. Wouldn't it be cool if in the last 10 minutes of the movie he said something?
Oh, man.
Wow.
And since a suit or a haircut says this, you know, it gets sort of embedded in the whole process. And there were something like three or four versions of the script that had this Snake Eyes dialogue in it. That became, I had to like prioritize things and say, well, you know, all this other stuff is, I got to just try to win this fight.
Yeah, no kidding.
And that just like takes away all the energy that you have to do all these other things.
Yeah, you gotta pick your battles.
You stick with the battles you can win.
Yeah.
But it's also, boy, it makes it, the whole creative process becomes a lot easier if everyone on board shares the same views.
And sure.
Shares the same vision.
Yeah, it's totally true. Yeah. And, you know, we're really excited to do both these projects. We're not sure which one's going to we're going to do first.
Mm-hmm.
We're really excited about where it's going to go. Part of what we're doing right now is that Larry's novel is a 300-page novel. So we're actually in the process of adapting that into a screenplay.
Nice.
That's some of the work that Joe and I are doing. We've kind of like swapped project for a little bit so that Joe and I will work on Larry's and Larry's going to work on Ghost Source, and that way we can kind of feel like it's truly a creative collaboration.
Yep.
But wow, you know, the way Larry writes, I remember listening to your podcast with Larry, and you guys were talking about the file cards and how he would make up a backstory for each one. Reading this novel is kind of like that. The characters feel completely real in their idiosyncrasies.
They are real.
they're totally
exactly.
real.
They're totally real.
I only made up one character.
Yeah, which is probably why it feels so real. And yet there are these really great moments where it follows this character who's trying to put his life of crime and his military career behind him to just live a quote-unquote normal life, but circumstances bring him back. And man, the way Larry writes action, it's fantastic. It's just like a great read, and I can't wait to actually, you know, put some of these action scenes on film.
Nice. Well, I'm sure most of us can't wait to see them on film. I think, you know, Larry's got a very very unique way that he tells a story, and I know all of us who have been G.I. Joe fans for as long as we have really look forward to whatever kind of new projects that come out of that fantastic brain of yours, Larry. We're looking forward to it.
We are psyched.
Oh, shucks.
Mark, it kind of answered my next question to you, is kind of what's next. If anyone's listening to the podcast and be interested in getting in contact with you for any roles, is it too early for them to contact you, or is there a place would you like for them to contact you for stuff like that?
Oh, heck, it's never too early. So Joe and I launched, we just launched a website and a production company to kind of represent all this business-wise. The website is planetnerdrage.com.
Nice.
And there's some contact information there. You can read a little bit about more about us and a little bit about the projects. We'll hopefully expand that out. The contact email is there.
Fantastic. You're going to be shooting this kind of around the New York City area, I'm assuming? That.
Yep, we're all New York, New Jersey based, so that's where we're going to be. And, you know, Larry's film takes place in the area.
Yep.
Ghost Source is pretty much, it's location agnostic, but I wrote it thinking about, you know, a large urban area like New York, so.
Sure.
Very cool.
Excellent.
Well, thank you for having us on.
Yeah, thank you guys.
No problem. Yeah.
I know me and Gary were totally honored that you guys would think of us to be a place where you want to come on and make this announcement. It's very, very cool of you guys all to come on and do this. We're big fans of all of your work and really look forward to seeing what you guys do in the future. And by all means, any kind of updates you guys have, any kind of other tidbits you want to get out there, feel free to let us know. We're happy to get you guys on and talk about these new projects.
Yeah, you're always welcome on the show.
Will do. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you much, guys.
Thank you, Larry. Great to talk to you again.
Thanks,
great to
Larry.
Talk to you again, Mark.
Good to talk to you,
Joe.
You
good
too, guys. All right, take care.
Right, take you care. Too. See you.
Bye.
All right, so shall we dip into the news bag? Shall we dip into the mailbag?
Gary's got his bags confused.
Let's dip.
Yeah, let's dip into the sack.
Yeah, I got my Speedo on.
Ooh.
Oh.
Well, as you can tell, the voice is much better this week. So, Justin, thank you for pinch hitting for me for the last couple of weeks for reading the letters. But I think I got these now.
You are very welcome, and it's all yours.
This first letter is from Eben. He says, I am a huge fan of the club and look forward to the 2012 con. With that being said, going back to October and the pictures of the FSS, there has been issues with the club and people aren't happy. The club has a ton on their plate, and in April are dealing with BotCon. 3 to 4 years ago, I believe, is when the Joe Club and the Transformer Clubs merged, and in my opinion, it was the worst thing to happen to the G.I. Joe Club. Does Hasbro have it where Fun Publications has to have both? The Joe Club has been run by Brian Savage and his team a very long time, and they are very much more G.I. Joe fans than Transformer fans. Why can't they just keep the club separate and let the Joe Club be the Joe Club? Seems ever since Transformers was added, service has been lacking. FunPub has way too much on their table, and because of it, people are b***ing and whining, and I mean, I don't even bother to go to certain sites anymore. I won't name the site, because people over there feel they should have some kind of compensation when, in fact, I look at it as FunPub is the one that got hacked, and it's not like they wanted this to happen. Anyways, just curious to what all you guys on WOJM, what's on your mind, think if the club might be overwhelmed with so much that they have to do. What do you think there, Chuck? The troubles that we've been seeing with FunPub, is it the Transformer Club's fault?
You know, I kind of have to agree with what Eben said. Ever since, because just come looking at the Transformer side, the fans have never been happy. Like, they've been content, but they haven't been happy. And I just really think if Fun Publications could run the Joe Club, which they were had been doing since 94 and were doing very, very nicely, that, you know, I never heard really any complaints about it. I mean, little things here and there, of course, I think that would be better. Now, I think a lot of the issues are from Transformer fans because they were used to a certain level of service. Well, not a certain level of service, but a certain style of the way things were done, and everything changed rather suddenly, and I think it's just something that they never adjusted to. And I should also mention that FunPub has been running both clubs for much longer than 4 years. This is actually going to be on like the 7th year of the Transformers Club, so that should give you like an idea. But, you know, I mean, I love Fun Publications overall. I think the people are relatively nice, decent, hardworking people. But it's like, you know, it's okay to say we have too much. And I think they should don't take everything from them. We don't want that. But if the Transformers fans were the new addition and that's when things started to unravel, maybe that ingredient should be removed.
Yeah, I do. I agree to a certain point that I think, yes, they're probably doing a little bit too much. It's combining the G.I. Joe and Transformers clubs into one entity without, I mean, I know they added a little bit more staff, but they didn't add a significant amount of staff, I don't believe. I think is going to just by its very nature create more work and you know, cause some logistical issues now and then. But I honestly don't know if Fun Publications and the G.I. Joe Collectors Club as an entity would exist without being, you know, having the Transformers Club license. Having gone to both BotCon and JoeCon, there's not even a comparison between the two of them as far as attendance goes and as far as, you know, overall interest goes. You know, you go to JoeCon, it's a fun gathering for the weekend. There's, you know, maybe 1,000 people, maybe 1,500 people. It's nice, you know, kind of relatively private. It seems pretty private. You know most of the people that are there. You know, it's a very fun kind of casual event. You go to BotCon and there are thousands of people there, and it's a big, huge global event. And I honestly don't know if Fun Publications could survive just running the G.I. Joe Collectors Club. I think they probably get a lot of income and a lot of money from the Transformers side of the house. And I don't know if given a choice, I don't know if they would voluntarily give it up. I mean, as far as do they have to run both? Well, at this point, yes, because they applied for the license from Hasbro. They were granted that license. They signed contracts. So at this point, you know, that's who Hasbro's going to give the ball to. I do agree to a certain extent, though. I think things were a lot simpler, were a lot more straightforward, and response, I think, was a little bit better when it was just the G.I. Joe Collectors Club. But I also, on the other hand, I'm not sure the club could survive having Transformers taken away from it.
I tend to think that actually having the Transformers group in the same entity has probably benefited the club, the Joe side, more than it's hurt it, because I don't think we're even... issues with the mainframe getting hacked aside, we're not talking about a figure subscription service without the capital that the Transformers Club generates to kickstart that. We're not talking about those 4-inch adventure team sets. It probably, you know, there's been a lot more product that's been put out in the last couple of years since the two clubs have kind of become one. And I think the Joe side has benefited more from the influx of cash. I don't know why that is. I would think that truthfully, just from a business standpoint, I would think that any money that they made on the Transformers side, they'd want to keep investing in that side. But these guys are, I think they are more, you are correct, even that they are more Joe fans than they are Transformer fans. I think it's silly for those of us on our side of the ball to complain about that particular arrangement, because I think we're the ones making out with an undue share of the benefits from it.
I think that's a good point, Mike, yeah.
And this is a loaded question. Shame on you for picking this one, Chuck.
Sorry.
Well, I think it's a viable topic to discuss.
Yes. It is certainly a very hot button issue right now. Yeah, a couple things. Just going down from top to bottom. And does Hasbro have it where FunPubs have to have both? No. I think when the Transformer license became available, I think they possibly approached FunPub. I will say that at the time they received the license and from that time forward, it would seem there's been a lot of circumstances, maybe coincidental, I don't know, that it seemed to... I think it really started with them taking a license and then Hurricane Katrina and then the delay of getting announcing the New Orleans convention, and then all of a sudden we had the Maulers, and unfortunately it was that one domino push, and it seems that everyone seems to be taking score right now. Wow. I don't know. I don't know. I sometimes wonder if they are a little distracted at times that they have, okay, look, we got the BotCon coming up. We need to focus in on that. And then when BotCon's over, JoeCon has our full attention. I don't know how they operate. I do know they have some separate staff that are dedicated to the Transformer side, and I know they had separate staff that's dedicated to the Joe side. That's definitely true, right, Justin?
It is to a degree, but I mean, if you go to either con, you see personnel from both sides at the convention. But
yeah, they're going to have all hands on deck, yeah, obviously working the convention. Of course,
they certainly have dedicated staff members who work mainly on the Transformer side, and dedicated staff members who work mainly on the Joe side. Yeah.
Now here's how I necessarily feel about data protection and getting hacked. It is very much the club's responsibility for what they do with their data. I say that because I'm an IT guy. If my company gets hacked, they're not looking at anybody else. They're coming right to the IT team saying, why the hell did we get hacked? You guys need to fix this. This is not acceptable. So the club is very much responsible for the protection of my data. I don't know beyond that, the legalities, and I really don't know what laws are that are protecting us, or I really don't know to what degree the legality of all this in. But I will tell you, and Justin has echoed it, and actually, Justin, your company has the additional responsibility of HIPAA.
Yes. Yeah, not only that, but I am the, as the Director of Information Services there, I am the HIPAA Security Officer.
Yep.
So if there is a significant HIPAA violation, I can be personally held responsible to the tune of $250,000 fine from the government. So obviously, I take security, online security, extremely seriously in my job, and I would expect a company like Fun Publications to do the same thing. It is unfortunate that it seems the more and more information that gets leaked out, the more it seems evident that I think they were tossing the information around casually, but it obviously wasn't taken care of nearly to the level that it should have been. But so that is clearly on FunPub's shoulders, and they deserve some of the blame for that, especially some of the information that's been coming out a little bit more recently with receipts with information on it that should not be there, and et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I take personal information and security of that nature. That's a big deal. And it should be a big deal. And I will admit, I've been a little bit taken aback by recent revelations over the past week or so that have kind of made it a little bit more evident exactly what was going on here.
I think kind of what separates us from when people say, hey, you're apologist, and this kind of goes over the last couple episodes when we've talked about it before, is I think the fact that we're not jumping up and down, we're not waving our hands, we're not calling the clubs. What good is it, Justin, Mike, Chuck, for us to say, look, you screwed up, you're stupid? It does us no good to do that. They know that they screwed up. They know they did. And it does us no good to jump up and down like a bunch of screaming fanboys. So I think we're probably taking a bit more calm than the average person. But my information's at risk. Justin's information's at risk. And Chuck, I know that you were concerned about your information being at risk. So it's not that we're not concerned. It's just the fact that what good is it really for us to jump up and down and act like a bunch of angry fanboys? Because at this point, it will gain us absolutely nothing to do that. So that's kind of why we're taking a different approach of being calm.
And I think some people mistake calm, rational statements with being an apologist and with thinking that, oh, it's okay. I mean, it's, I don't want to, and that's where we got to try to walk the line. We're not going to come on this podcast and jump up and down, like you said, and be like, the club sucks, Hasbro's going to take their license, rah, rah, rah. And we got to, I think the fandom really benefits from taking things rationally, thinking about it, and making an educated statement. That's the only thing. And obviously, and just because we're trying to be calm and take everything step by step, it doesn't mean that we're somehow condoning what happened. I think the fact that this data got out there is it's pretty pathetic. It's pretty reprehensible. You know, obviously stuff like this happens.
I think not telling us for 4 weeks after it happened is more reprehensible.
But I think, I mean, this isn't anything new. This is stuff we've been saying on the show for several weeks. So, I mean, I don't know. Obviously, Gary and I have been seeing some comments online about club apologists and so on and so forth. And we're kind of trying to address that fact, I think, without directly addressing that fact. We are aware that people think there are club apologists. I've been accused of being one for years and years now.
Oftentimes on this program.
Exactly. And just because we're not flipping out and throwing F-bombs and demanding drastic action doesn't mean we think this is okay. It's not okay. It was a very poor lack of forethought. I mean, me and Gary have been making a running joke since the very first show that I've been on here about how poor the club's software system is for navigating the forum and stuff. And that looks like it reflects directly on, you know, how up to date their security software was. So obviously it's not something we're happy with, and we're going to speak out about it, but we're not going to be a-holes about it. So I think that's kind of
where to be. Yeah, we're here to be informative. God forbid we're here to try and be entertaining. I know we fall flat on that quite a bit of the time.
And I blame Mike.
That is largely my fault, and I make no apologies. But again, we're here to be informative. We're here to be entertaining. We're not here to just grab the torches and the pitchforks and lead the charge in that regard. Mm-hmm. There's enough of that going around, and after a while, you know, you guys aren't going to be informed or entertained by us reiterating the stuff that you've seen in any one of a dozen forums online. So, not us. We do appreciate your feelings. I don't want to make it sound like we're blowing you off, but it's not us.
And there you go.
Somebody's getting blown.
and even by all means, we kind of transitioned on you there. That's not in relation to your letter. I think your letter had a completely different point that we kind of turned into something else.
Yeah, it so, just kind of opened the club can of worms, so to speak.
Yeah, don't take that as a shot at you, sir. It's thank you for writing to us and asking a very good question. Actually,
I know I feel bad. But, we kind of
went off on a different direction. I don't want to make it sound like we're going off on you.
And the letter was kind of like, you know, I'm tired of hearing all these bad stories, and it kind of went off on a bad story. So I do apologize about that as well, even. But I think that was kind of something that needed to be said just based on what I've seen and heard online, and wanted to make perfectly clear what our stance is on this particular matter.
There he goes apologizing again.
All right. Thanks, Eben. We certainly appreciate it. You did bring up it was very much a hot button letter, asking us the hard questions, answering them. That's what we do.
Absolutely.
Okay, the second letter is from Barry, a.k.a. Crazy Legs, on, I believe he says, Joe Canuck. Hi, guys. I just wanted to drop a line and let you know I really get a lot from your show. You all do a great job. I enjoy the digs and jabs at each other that are harmless, and the chemistry works great. I've learned so much more of my passion of G.I. Joe from listening to you all and the awesome guests you have on. Thank you very much. My question is, do you sponsor a charity or nonprofit organization? He goes on to tell us he's an illustrator, comic book artist, and graphic designer. I've been living with Korn's disease for 10 years now with 4 operations. I hope I said that right.
I think it's Crohn's. I don't know if
it's Crohn's.
Crohn's, yes.
Crohn's, okay. C-O-R-H-N-A. Yeah, Crohn's disease. Okay, my apologies. It's a digestive illness and an immune system illness. It's degenerative and takes a lot from you. As a result of the disease, I've been recently diagnosed with fibromyalgia. That is a chronic pain and weakness illness. Needless to say, I've been through my share of battles, being sick in and out of the hospital. One thing that really does help me is my 80s Joe collection. I started up again after this summer being given a Cobra Rattler and then jumping on the Joe sites, for instance, Joe Canuck, and eBay to refit the Rattler. From there, I just couldn't stop, and I hauled out my old Joes and been building a nice collection. I find just time with the Joes and stuff really therapeutic, and the hobby and love for this toy line has really helped me while being sick. Do you ever think you'll do a show on people being sick and how G.I. Joe has helped them in those hard times? Keep up the great work. I'm on here now to listen to episode 46. Well, thanks for listening. In terms of sponsoring a charity or nonprofit organization, we did do the Hits for Tots, the Toys for Tots at Christmas time. But in terms of beyond that, no, we haven't. But it's not a bad idea. What do you think, guys?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, I'm certainly all for supporting the charities and things of that nature. I'm not sure how we'd raise money necessarily. It's something I'm certainly open to.
I think it isn't in our own personal lives. We each do our own little charity work. I know.
That's a good point, Chuck. Yep.
I mean, I've mentioned my work with Boy Scouting over the years, and there is actually something when we get to the shout-outs I'll be talking about.
Cool. Yeah, that might be kind of the best way we can probably support charities is just by doing it, you know, our own private ways necessarily. I don't know if we'd really be able to find, beyond Toys for Tots, we'd be able to find a common charity that everybody on the show would agree with and kind of latch onto. I think we each individually kind of support things in our own way.
And it is a bit of a natural fit for us, both from the standpoint that they give toys to kids and the, you know,
exactly,
fact that it's military-based.
Yep.
So it's kind of the natural one for us. But if you've got any ideas, I mean, we're certainly not going to turn away the opportunity to do good things for people if we can somehow work it out. You know,
unless it's Chuck, screw him.
Unless it's Chuck, because Chuck's kind of, he's a little bit self-serving. Yes, that's the word. No, Chuck's not self-serving at all. Chuck probably does more than the rest of us do in terms of building his community.
I would agree with that.
You know, and by all means, that's to the other point. We'll put it out there to the listenership, actually. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. If you guys want us to do an episode like this, if you want us to talk to folks who are maybe not in the best of health and use G.I. Joe as kind of their release, we'd be happy to do that episode. But mm-hmm. we also need to, we got to be able to find you. So yep. if that's something, as always, anytime you have a show idea, let us know. I mean, that's the best part of this, Barry. Thank you very much for letting us know. Now that this one is out there, by all means, get on Facebook, get on Twitter, hit us up on our Podbean site, whatsonjoemind.podbean.com. You know, even hit up
slash
our own
Chuck
personal slash chuckdog 1999. Even hit up our personal projects, man. We'll take your messages there. Hit up Justin's site. Hit up Chuck's YouTube channel. We are listening, and we want to do what you want to hear, Barry. I have a good friend who suffers from Crohn's, and that is a tough deal. So you do your best to stay healthy.
So do I, Mike, and I know it's not a lot of fun.
Thanks for writing, and stay in touch. And that will take us to intermission.
Well done.
Got a good one in there. Thank you.
This portion of What's on Joe Mine is brought to you by Kokomo Toys. Find one of the largest selections of G.I. Joe anywhere in the Midwest, from vintage Joes to the latest straight from Hasbro. They're independently owned and operated. Visit their store in Kokomo, Indiana, or online at KokomoToys.com today. Here's how you can contact the show. Email us at whatsonjoemind@gmail.com. Text or leave us a voicemail at 262-515-9656. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/whatsonjoemind. Visit our homepage at whatsonjoemind.podbean.com, where you find links to our social networking profiles and active community forum threads. Got an Apple device? Go to the iTunes store and subscribe to the show. Hear us on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher works on Apple, BlackBerry, WebOS, and Android devices. Download the app for free at Stitcher.com or at your mobile app store. Stitcher Smart Radio and What's on Joe Mind, together with a smarter way to listen to radio. Find our podcast mirrored every week at InsidePulse.com. Inside Pulse is a pop culture mega site covering movies, music, sports, games, and more. Check out the Pulse of Pop Culture at InsidePulse.com. We're part of the GeekCast Radio Network. GeekCast Radio Network features multiple podcasts featuring Transformers, cartoons, movies, television, general geek topics, and interviews with many famous voice actors from your favorite shows. So go there now and unleash the geek in you and tell them how much you enjoy What's on Joe Mine. And now a few words from our partner podcasts.
2012 marks the 30th anniversary for Masters of the Universe. We here at the GCRN are celebrating with a brand new series of podcasts. The Powers of Grayskull series will cover every episode of every MOTU cartoon. Yes, even that crappy New Adventure stuff. Join Optimus Solo and TFG1 Mike as they tell tales of Eternia, discover the myths of Etheria, become masters in space, and finally, masters of Grayskull. You can find the Pogs podcasts in iTunes and the web at www.geekcastradio.com. Good journey! Grab your helmets because it's time to assemble Mask. Coming April 10th, 2012, the Geekcast Radio Network launches Masked Mayhem with your hosts Optimus Solo and TFG1 Mike. This podcast, covering all 75 episodes of Mask, will feature in-depth analysis of every episode, talk on the toys, and more. Mask Mayhem will run 30 podcast episodes. You can find us in iTunes and on www.geekcastradio.com. Get your spectrums ready, as podcasting is the ultimate weapon.
Do you like retro shows? Did you grow up in either the 80s or the 90s? Then tune into Telecast, geekcastradio.com's newest podcast. Join us here on the Telecast as we revisit some of your favorite shows, such as Clarissa Explains It All, Salute Your Shorts, Saved by the Bell, and much, much more, only on GeekCastRadio.com.
Welcome to a collaboration between the GeekCast Radio Network and the Pop Culture Network. This is From the Command Center, the podcast. I am your host, TFG and Mike from the GCRN, and joining me is Zordon himself. Scotty Cash.
That's right, Scotty Cash from the Pop Culture Network, and today we're introducing you to the audio version of From the Command Center, the podcast that will tell our intake on Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, the episodes, the seasons, and all that other good stuff. Band of
The second half of What's On Joe Mine is brought to you by JoeArmory.com. Joe Armory is a proud sponsor of What's On Joe Mine. Stop on by JoeArmory.com to experience the internet's largest inventory for all things G.I. Joe, from 12 inch to 3 and 3 quarter and everything in between. Joe Armory is your source. And now it's time for the news with Beachhead Mike. Gathering the best G.I. Joe news from all points around the fandom and community, it's the weekly What's On Joe Mine News Desk with your host and anchor, Beachhead Mike.
Holy cow, it's time for the news.
How about that? What do we got on store for the headlines this week, Mike?
All right, new headlines. Of course, the G.I. Joe Club is in our headlines. They cannot escape us. But this time it's a good thing. The new Joe Club store is online. Again, granted, with what's been going on, I don't know how business has been for them, but you can once again buy from the G.I. Joe Collectors Club with their new and improved software and security system. Buy with confidence. And does anybody else? I mean, we kind of discussed that at the beginning part of the show. I don't necessarily want to get into that again. Are we good there?
Yeah, but it's not so much an all-purpose online store. It's there set up right now for people who want to sign up for the memberships. It doesn't have a full inventory or anything like that. It's just basically a new secure site where people can renew their club memberships or sign up for their new club memberships. And that's essentially what it is right now. It should eventually kind of expand into the full-blown store, but at this point it's primarily just for the memberships. And they've also extended the membership deadline to, I think, the 21st, which is tomorrow, which means you probably won't be listening to this before the deadline is there again. You know, they wrap that all together to give people a couple extra days to get that in.
Unless that slacker Gary gets on it tonight.
Get on it, Gary. Edited and posted by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. Let's make it happen.
This is going to be an interesting edit job on this one, I can tell you already. I will say, by looking at the, because this is, we basically got this headline based upon the email they sent out on or about the 17th of this month. A couple of things they want you to do right away is they want you to go to the new site, which is toyorama.com. And actually, it's going to be, it's a little bit different. It's, for those of you concerned about security, it is an HTTPS, so it's a secure HTTP site with certificates and everything. https://toyorama.com. That's toyorama.com/store. I believe they already have migrated accounts over, so each membership must have its own unique email account, and that email account is the email they sent this letter to. So if you don't know what your email account is, just find the email. Hopefully you have it, and then find out what email account of yours they sent it to if you have multiple accounts. Your password is still the same password that you used previously when you logged into the old G.I. Joe Club site. They recommend that you go to your settings page, your profile page, once you log in and change your password to something that's non-standard. Non-standard strong passwords normally include capitals, special characters, numbers, that type of thing. And I would definitely make it longer than 8 with any combination of one of those type of, possibly 2 of those type of characters in there. Something that you'll remember, but something certainly that is a strong password. Do not put your dog's name or something like that. Justin and I will tell you, typically, the greatest way to find passwords is just lift the person's keyboard of the desk that you're working at, and there'll be sticky notes underneath that with passwords on there. So make them strong.
Sometimes right on the
monitor. On the monitors are the best ones, yeah. Those are the non-secure ones. The secure ones, they hide under the keyboard. Did I miss anything on an email that maybe somebody else would like to point out that they suggest that people should do?
No, I don't think so. I think that pretty much covered what they sent out in their advisory.
And then some.
Well, there you go, Mike.
All right, excellent. Headline number 2. Okay, I'm not going to do that again. G.I. Joe retaliation prototypes have been showing up on eBay.
I said the bad word. They're not prototypes.
Oh, no, I suppose they are early release projects. I'm just going by the exact headline that Chuck has written down in the show notes, because we know
Chuck, you said a bad word, Chuck.
We know how testy he gets when I don't read exactly what's on the headline.
Last thing anybody needs is a testy Chuck, right, Chuck?
Yeah. Whatever, it's only when the headline is particularly funny and taking a shot at you that I get to see.
You did get the rim shot last week, Chuck, so that was a good and a very creative headline that you did last week.
Thank you.
I disagree.
We don't pay attention to you, Justin. That's okay. But anyways, maybe you would like to provide us some input on the retaliation product that is appearing on eBay.
Yeah, they look to be some, you know, early test shots, samples, whatever you want to, whatever terminology you want to use. They look to be relatively finalized. The paint jobs look pretty final. They've got a chunk of accessories. Doesn't look like they have all their accessories online. There was a seller named Viper Kingdom who had a Cobra Trooper, a G.I. Joe Trooper, Snake Eyes, and I believe Storm Shadow. Most right. of them have since been purchased.
Yeah.
I think the Cobra Trooper is still lingering out there, like a $32 buy it now. I don't know if any of the others are. Snake Eyes, I think, might be still too. But yeah, so there's a couple early samples, which means they are probably on their way shortly, probably right in line with an April-May release schedule. So people who are into that type of thing, keep your eyes open. I, of course, am not. I would never do anything like that.
Neither should I.
Gary prefers to send his requests by carrier pigeon flying over the Pacific Ocean to China.
Oh, shit.
What the hell was that? I don't even know what kind of noise that was.
Yeah, it was like a narwhal, a beach narwhal.
That was my response to Justin and Gary's holier-than-thou statements of that they would never dip into the lunchtime specials.
The lunchtime, I like that.
Anyways, Mike, take over.
Moving on.
Right down the crapper.
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty well par for the course during the news segment.
Yeah.
But we've got a Transformers G.I. Joe trade coming out on September 11th of 2012.
Cool.
And that'll be published by IDW Publishing, naturally, yeah. As the folks who hold both the G.I. Joe and Transformers license. So be sure to check your previews and order that, or check your local comic shop on September 11th and pick that one up.
Definitely.
And that is the news.
And that's all the news from Beachhead Mike and What's On Your Mind.
All right.
All right.
Good grief.
We're a high-class organization.
High-class and high-society. And now it's time for shout-outs and what we got in this week. Chuck, start us off. What we get?
Okay. First of all, I want to give a shout-out to Justin. As was already mentioned earlier in the show, he has front-paged a couple of my newer video reviews, G.I. Joe-related, of course, after much guilting and shaming. But he did it anyway, and I appreciate it. Want to give a special shout-out, as always, every week, to the Figure Subscription Service.
All rise for this week's honoring of the Figure Subscription Service.
Your day is coming. I think it's actually coming much sooner now with this new storefront. But you are not forgotten. Those images are etched into my memory, as well as many others.
And which figure are we honoring this week?
Oh, let's see. Who do we want to honor? I think we got to go with Slice.
Slice?
The
Cobra, okay.
The Cobra Ninja.
You are not forgotten. You're not even
Mike's just moved into a four chorus.
His truth is marching on.
Everyone may now be seated.
Okay, and then finally, I alluded to this very earlier in the show, but over the weekend, I was able to take part in something very special. Right before Christmas in December, a former teacher I had at St. Francis Preparatory School in Fresh Meadows, New York, a man by the name of Mark Tiafolo, passed away very suddenly, very unexpectedly. Many of his former students have come together to do many charitable works in his honor. One of the things we are doing is trying to endow a scholarship fund. I don't know how it is in other states, but in New York, a lot of the public schools are cutting their music education programs due to cost. There is a 12-hour music marathon that took place where the current student musical ensembles, some of the faculty, as well as members of the alumni who were former students of Mr. Tiafolo, who have reunited, played, as well as having a silent auction. And I won the opportunity in December to guest conduct one of the, I think it was the concert band during the Christmas concert. Now, obviously, that's 9 months away, and we'll talk more about it then, because I'm pretty sure it will also be part of this endowment for the scholarship. Basically, endowing the scholarship means we need to raise a certain amount of money that once it's put into the fund and interest and what have you, will be able to perpetuate itself over the years to ensure that the individual who's awarded this scholarship will be given an opportunity at this type of education and for a music education. So I just want to let people know that's what I'll be doing. So keep an eye out for it.
Very cool. And give us that that YouTube channel again, Jack.
It is youtube.com/ChuckDog1999.
/ChuckDog1999. All joking aside, Chuck, we are proud of you.
That's excellent.
Justin, what did you get in this week?
What did I get in this week? I didn't get a whole heck of a lot in this week. I did get some IDW comics that Infestation Part 2, which or Infestation 2 Issue Number 1, which was actually pretty cool. They introduced IDW's version of Cobra Law, which is actually an insane asylum underneath some Cobra facilities, which was pretty cool. Got to see a little Crystal, a little Raptor, and a little Cesspool action, which was awesome. So I got that in. I got G.I. Joe Number 11 as well, and Snake Eyes Number 11 as well, all from IDW. So pretty decent week of comics. But that's really pretty much it as far as what I got in. I didn't buy a whole lot this week. I'm trying to resist the urge to spend my money on frivolous things that I don't need because there's no G.I. Joe toys to buy. I do have a couple shout-outs, though. I do want to give a shout-out to, first and foremost, Robert Adkins, who is not only joined Gary and James over in the UK for Rollout Roll Call 3, but also is in the midst of a Kickstarter campaign for a project that he's working on. It's not G.I. Joe related, but it's Elders of the Runestone, which you can find at Kickstarter.com. It's got kind of a long URL with the number in it, so probably just hopping on Kickstarter.com and searching for Elders of the Runestone is probably the easiest way to go about it, or just go to his blog page, which is robertadkinsart.blogspot.com, and you can find links there as well. And it's a very cool comic project, it looks like. They are actually doing a great job with their funding. It looks like they're actually over their funding limit right now. The goal was $9,000. They're at $9,252, but they are obviously going to continue taking funds because the more they get, the better quality product they can put out. It looks like a pretty interesting comic. If you go to Kickstarter.com and search Elders of the Runestone, you can watch a little video with some artwork. It looks very cool. It's something that I'm kind of into, and I'm definitely gonna do my part for the Kickstarter project myself. So I encourage people who are fans of Robert Adkins to hop on there and do something similar. Did want me to let folks know that he has put a hold on commissions for the next few months, at least until summer. But anybody who gets onto Kickstarter and does a project donation up to the commission level, he's going to put that aside and actually do that commission for you, bump you right into the front of the list. So if you're thinking about getting a commission from Robert, this is probably the very good time to do it, because you not only can get a commission from him, but you can also help a project that he's working on as well. So once again, Kickstarter.com, search out Elders of the Runestone and see if we can help Robert Adkins with this little project he's working on, and hopefully he will be joining us next week as well. He may talk about this a little bit. He'll probably talk a little bit about Rollout Roll Call 3 as well, and we always love having Robert on, so we're looking forward to him being on next week.
Mike, anything new with you?
Let's see. Yeah, not a whole lot in the way of product. There are still some figures that I do have to chase down from recently, but I kind of put that off. I made some debtors happy with me this week, which is important as well. The only advice I can give the community at large is just be careful who you marry.
Do you actually pay bills instead of buying toys? What the hell's wrong with you, dude?
I know. Yeah, it does work out that way sometimes. I still got to get me some Dreadnought 7-packs, or rather Marauders and Dreadnought 7-packs. I have yet to do that. I've got to get on that one before they sell down or kick the price up on me.
Yep.
But we, of course, are always accepting donations. Maybe that's it. Maybe I need to start my own Kickstarter. Let's get Mike some Joe's Kickstarter fund. Maybe that's what we got to do.
Love it. what's on Joe Mine Kickstarter project to buy us some new audio equipment? I wonder how that would work.
Everyone else is doing it. Why not? Let's go ahead.
Get Gary a mixing board.
Hey, Mike, just to add to your list of shout-outs from last week, don't forget joearmory.com.
Okay, I won't forget joearmory.com, although I clearly did last week.
We should never forget joearmory.com.
I clearly did last week, so my apologies to the fine folks at joearmory.com for leaving you out in my hastily prepared rant during last week's shout-out section.
They're sponsoring the second half of the program, yes.
And, of course, I give a shout-out to all of our fine sponsors and the folks who do support us. Thank you so much for your time and efforts.
And cash money.
I'll thank them for that when it starts rolling in, Justin.
I'm a little bit like you guys. I did not get an awful lot in this week. I believe the only thing that I bought last week was digital copy of Fury's Big Week.
Good man, Gary.
Yeah, damn you. Damn you, Rune. Damn you, Ryan Panagos, for making me buy these digital Marvel comics.
Dude, I'm right there with you. I bought Avengers Assemble this week too, which was...
I bought that too. I forgot about that. I'm looking at it right now. So I jumped in both feet first on the freaking Avengers prequel stuff. So the other big news to announce is got kind of the okay from Mr. Mike Kettle. We are now the official podcast of 2012 Canadian JoeCon. So another big show that we will be the official podcast of. So we are looking forward to promoting the heck out of that. And that's really it for me.
That's very cool news. Very cool of Mike to do that.
They're going to put us up at Canadian JoeCon. We're going to do a show there.
Are we all going to go? I know I'm going to be there. Are you going to be there, Mike?
If people are paying for me to show, I may show.
Oh, there we go.
I mean, I may show. Well, I mean, there is always the transport thing, which makes that an iffy proposition. But I'm just saying that.
Do you have your passport?
No, but I kind of need to do. I needed to do that anyway.
Yeah, you need a passport to go.
Well, sure, Gary, but I'm just saying.
Okay.
And that is a situation that could be fixed between now and June.
You need to hurry. Yep.
When is Canadian JoeCon this year?
August 10th and 11th, 142 days from today.
August 10th and 11th. And where is Canadian JoeCon this year?
The beautiful Sheraton, Toronto Airport Sheraton. Yeah, Toronto Airport Sheraton. And it's a nice venue. It's the third year they've been there, so...
Excellent.
Looking forward to it.
And being in August, that means we'll catch Toronto in its warm season, so it will be a blistering 53 degrees.
And the Blue Jays will already be eliminated from the playoffs.
most likely, but at least they'll be fun to watch.
And we can all enjoy, together, without snickering, poutine.
That's right. No, I'd still be snickering. I'd still be snickering. I'm sorry.
I know if Chuck was there, he'd be all upset because he went to like the dark corners of Toronto asking for poutine and got gravy fries and doesn't know what's up with it.
And that's all I got this week.
No shout outs to Peyton Manning dethroning Tim Tebow as the Lord and Savior.
Let's talk about that. Yeah, it's Peyton Manning dethroned the Son of God. How'd that happen?
Yeah.
What the hell are you guys going to do with Dante Stallworth?
Cut him before training camp, probably.
You know, Reggie Wayne told you guys no. I found out about that this week.
That's all right. We'll see who makes it further in the playoffs. The Patriots.
Playoffs?
Colts this year.
Playoffs? We're talking about playoffs?
Playoffs?
Playoffs. I miss that soundbite.
Yeah, you don't think Reggie Wayne cares about winning? He just said, thank you, I'll take my $17 million and I'll stay where I am. You know, he's getting a rookie quarterback.
Well, Luck needs somebody to throw to because there ain't nobody left. Ollie's still here. But
I was say, it's one of those semantic things, really. Is it really worse to miss the playoffs,
playoffs
than it is to lose in the Super Bowl to the New York Giants 27-17?
Yes,
it's really it's a question of which really is worse. I think really Colts fans were spared more pain than Patriots fans coming so close.
Colts fans had 16 weeks of pain. I'll take a week of pain over 16 weeks of pain. 16 weeks of pain watching your savior quarterback move to another team and realize you've got about another at least 10 years of futility ahead of you.
That's fine until next year when they start replaying all the NFL films editions of the Super Bowl, and then you see that the last two you went against the Giants, you lost.
Yeah, whatever.
So, yeah, I will say no one will remember a 2-14 Colts season. I'll tell you that much.
They'll remember the several 3-13 and 2-14 seasons in a row when Andrew Luck comes on board and sh**s the bed. they'll remember the decade of futility post Peyton Manning.
Wow. Somebody's not sold on the number one overall pick.
No. Someone has a sandy vagina, so we'll see.
We'll see how many of those guaranteed number one picks that are always, you know, they're guaranteed to work out and how many of them actually do work out.
In Justin's favor, to argue, to play literally devil's advocate, as Justin is Satan.
All right, let's get on out of here.
That's it for this episode. You can talk to us at whatsonjoemind@gmail.com. You can call or text us at 262-515-9656. Just because the show is over doesn't mean the fun ends. Join us on Twitter during the week, head on over to our Podbean site and find our Twitter profiles on the right-hand side of the page. As always, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/whatsonjoemind. Host bios, community forum threads, and archive episodes, along with everything else with our show, can be found on our webpage, whatsonjoemind.podbean.com. Visit and bookmark it today. Download our show at iTunes, InsidePulse.com, and Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is smart radio for your phone. Find it for free in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio and What's On Joe Mind, we're the smarter way to listen to radio. Check out GeekCastRadio.com for other great podcast shows such as Movie Week in Review, GCRN Retro, Tooncast Beyond, and Mass Mayhem. Go to GeekCastRadio.com and unleash the geek in you today.
All right, joining us next week is Kevin Watts and Robert Atkins. We're going to see how many times Kevin Watts will get leaked again next week. That ought to be interesting.
The over-under that Vegas has set for us, if you're into sports betting, but I know that's illegal, so you're not. The over-under is 55.5.
I'll take the over.
I'll take the over as well.
He came pretty damn close when he did that phone call about Chuck. So, Kevin Watts and Robert Atkins, there's your combination.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize in advance, Robert.
Kevin is a believer in my credo, leaping is funny.
To thank Flint Dilly, Mark Chang, Joe Barbagallo, and Larry Hama for joining us this week. And hey, we got a sequel with Flint coming up, so stay tuned. So for our showrunner, Chuck, co-host Justin and Mike, I'm Gary saying to all our men and women serving, God bless, Godspeed, and come home safe. Good night, folks, and thanks for listening. We will catch you in the next episode of What's On Joe Mind, now the official podcast of the 2012 Canadian JoeCon. See ya.
Bye. It's only a couple of weeks, too, before I don't get to abuse you about football anymore, and I get to abuse you about baseball.